Welcome back to A Year of War and Peace, the podcast where we go from War and Peace Zero to War and Peace Hero in 1 year flat. I'm going to start this episode by diving back into the previous chapter, just really quickly, because I did have to do a bit of a rush job at the end of last chapter, so I'll just cover a few things now. So they talked a lot about these Gascons. Now, Gascons are people from Gascony, which is a place in South France, and so those people were Napoleonites. And there was three people mentioned, Lannes, Baliard, and Murat. So Lannes was Jean Lannes. He was one of Napoleon's generals. In Wikipedia, it says he was one of Napoleon's most daring and talented generals. And Napoleon once commented on Lannes, "I found him a pygmy and left him a giant." It says he was a friend, a personal friend, of the emperor, and he was allowed to address him with the familiar tu, as opposed to the formal vu. I'm not really sure the implication of that, but it seems they were on like almost like a first name basis kind of thing. Baliard was another general for Napoleon, and his character Murat is an interesting one. Joachim Murat. He was a marshal of France for Napoleon, and he was also Napoleon's brother-in-law. So he was married to Napoleon's younger sister, Caroline Bonaparte. It says in Wikipedia he was noted as a daring, brave, and charismatic cavalry officer, as well as a flamboyant dresser, and was known as the Dandy King. So it was these three, Murat, Lannes, and Baliard, who decided to be a little bit proactive and try to go and win this bridge. This bridge that was mined up and ready to blow, and somehow through this bit of a bluff that they've done, they've managed to secure the bridge and cross their armies over. And so that's why in this in the previous chapter, Bilibin and co. are getting ready to evacuate. They know those three, Lannes, Baliard, and Murat, and their armies are on the way. All right, with that cleared up, let's jump into the next chapter. This is chapter 13 of book 2 of Leo Tolstoy's War and Peace. That same night, having taken leave of the Minister of War, Bolkonski set off to rejoin the army, not knowing where he would find it and fearing to be captured by the French on the way to Krems. In Brünn, everybody attached to the court was packing up and the heavy baggage was already being dispatched to Olmutz. Near Hetzeldorf, Prince Andrew struck the high road along which the Russian army was moving with great haste and in the greatest disorder. The road was so obstructed with carts that it was impossible to get by in a carriage. Prince Andrew took a horse and a Cossack from a Cossack commander and, hungry and weary, making his way past the baggage wagons, rode in search of the commander-in-chief and of his own luggage. Very sinister reports of the position of the army reached him as he went along, and the appearance of the troops in their disorderly flight confirmed these rumours. Cette armée russe que lors de l'Angleterre a transporté des extrémités de l'univers, nous allons lui faire éprouver la même sorte, le sort de l'armée de Ulm. Sorry for butchering that, I have no idea what I was saying. Apparently, according to the footnotes, that translates to that Russian army, which has been brought from the ends of the earth by English gold, we shall cause to share the same fate, the fate of the army at Ulm. He remembered these words in Bonaparte's address to his army at the beginning of the campaign, and they awoke in him astonishment at the genius of his hero, a feeling of wounded pride, and a hope of glory. And should there be nothing left but to die, he thought, well, if need be, I shall do it no worse than others. He looked with disdain at the endless, confused mass of detachments, carts, guns, artillery, and again baggage wagons and vehicles of all kinds, overtaking one another and blocking the muddy road, three and sometimes four abreast, from all sides, behind and before, as far as ear could reach. There was the rattle of wheels, the creaking of carts and gun carriages, the tramp of horses, the crack of whips, shouts, the urging of horses, and the swearing of soldiers, orderlies, and officers. All along the sides of the road, fallen horses were to be seen, some flayed, some not, and broken down carts, besides which solitary soldiers sat waiting for something, and again soldiers straggling from their companies, crowds of whom set off to the neighbouring villages or returned from them dragging sheep, fowls, hay, and bulging sacks. At each ascent or descent of the road, the crowds were yet denser, and the din of shouting more incessant. Soldiers floundering knee-deep in mud pushed the guns and wagons themselves. Whips cracked, hooves slipped, traces broke, and lungs were strained with shouting. The officers, directing the march, rode backward and forward between the carts. Their voices were but feebly heard amid the uproar, and one saw but their faces that they despaired of the possibility of checking this disorder. "Here is our dear Orthodox Russian army," thought Bolkonski, recalling Bilibin's words. Wishing to find out where the commander-in-chief was, he rode up to a convoy. Directly opposite to him came a strange one-horse vehicle, evidently rigged up by soldiers out of any available materials and looking like something between a cart, a cabriolet, and a caliche. A soldier was driving, and a woman, enveloped in shawls, sat behind the apron, under the leather hood of the vehicle. Prince Andrew rode up and was just putting his question to a soldier when his attention was diverted by the desperate shrieks of the woman in the vehicle. An officer in charge of transport was beating the soldier who was driving the woman's vehicle for trying to get ahead of others, and the strokes of his whip fell on the apron of the equipage. The woman screamed piercingly. Seeing Prince Andrew, she leaned out from behind the apron, and waving her thin arms from under the woolen shawl, cried, "Mr. Aide-de-camp, Mr. Aide-de-camp, for heaven's sake, protect me. What will become of us? I am the wife of the doctor of the 7th Chasseurs. They won't let us pass. We are left behind and have lost our people." "I'll flatten you into a pancake," shouted the angry officer to the soldier. "Turn back with your slut."
"Mr. Aide-de-camp, help me. What does it all mean?" screamed the doctor's wife.
"Kindly let this cart pass. Don't you see it's a woman?" said Prince Andrew, riding up to the officer. The officer glanced at him and, without replying, turned again to the soldier. "I'll teach you to push on. Back!"
"Let them pass, I tell you," repeated Prince Andrew, compressing his lips.
"And who are you?" cried the officer, turning on him with tipsy rage. "Who are you? Are you in command here, eh?"
"I am command here, not you. Go back or I'll flatten you into a pancake," repeated he.
This expression evidently pleased him. "That was a nice snub for the little aide-de-camp," came a voice from behind. Prince Andrew saw that the officer was in that state of senseless, tipsy rage when a man does not know what he is saying. He saw that his championship of the doctor's wife, in her queer trap, might expose him to what he dreaded more than anything in the world, to ridicule. But his instinct urged him on. Before the officer finished his sentence, Prince Andrew, his face distort with fury, rode up to him and raised his riding whip.
"Kindly let them pass."
The officer flourished his arm and hastily rode away. "It's all the fault of these fellows on the staff that there's this disorder," he muttered. "Do as you like." Prince Andrew, without lifting his eyes, rode hastily away from the doctor's wife, who was calling him her deliverer, and recalling with a sense of disgust the minutest details of this humiliating scene, he galloped on to the village where he was told that the commander-in-chief was. On reaching the village, he dismounted and went to the nearest house, intending to rest, if but for a moment, eat something, and try to sort out the stinging and tormenting thoughts that confused his mind. "This is a mob of scoundrels and not an army," he was thinking as he went up to the window of the first house, when a familiar voice called him by name. He turned around. Nesvitsky's handsome face looked out of the little window. Nesvitsky moved his moist lips as he chewed something, and flourishing his arm, called him to enter.
"Bolkonski, Bolkonski, don't you hear, eh? Come quick," he shouted.
Entering the house, Prince Andrew saw Nesvitsky and another adjutant having something to eat. They hastily turned round to him, asking if he had any news. On their familiar faces, he read agitation and alarm. This was particularly noticeable on Nesvitsky's usually laughing countenance.
Where is the commander-in-chief? Asked Bolkonski.
Here, in that house, answered the adjutant.
Well, is it true that it's peace and capitulation? Asked Nesvitsky.
I was going to ask you, I know nothing, except that it was all I could do to get here.
And we, my dear boy, it's terrible.
It was wrong to laugh at Mac.
We're getting it still worse, said Nesvitsky.
But sit down and have something to eat.
You won't be able to find either your baggage or anything else now, Prince, and God only knows where your man Peter is, said the other adjutant.
Where are headquarters?
We are to spend the night in Znaim.
Well, I have got all I need into packs for 2 horses, said Nesvitsky.
They've made up splendid packs for me, fit to cross the Bohemian Mountains with.
It's a bold lookout, old fellow. But what's the matter with you? You must be ill to shiver like that, he added, noticing that Prince Andrew winced as at an electric shock.
It's nothing, replied Prince Andrew. He had just remembered his recent encounter with the doctor's wife and the convoy officer.
What is the commander-in-chief doing here? He asked.
I can't make out at all, said Nesvitsky.
Well, all I can make out is that everything is abominable.
Abominable, quite abominable, said Prince Andrew. And he went off to the house where the commander-in-chief was. Passing by Kutuzov's carriage and the exhausted saddle horses of his suite, with their Cossacks who were talking loudly together, Prince Andrew entered the passage. Kutuzov himself, he was told, was in the house with Prince Bagration and Weyrother. Weyrother was an Austrian general who had succeeded Schmidt. In the passage, little Kozlovsky was squatting on his heels in front of a clerk. The clerk, with cuffs turned up, was hastily writing at a tub turned bottom upwards. Kozlovsky's face looked worn. He, too, had evidently not slept all night. He glanced at Prince Andrew and did not even nod to him.
Second line, have you written it? He continued, dictating to the clerk.
The Kief Grandiers, Podolain.
One can't write so fast, Your Honour, said the clerk, glancing angrily and disrespectfully at Kozlovsky.
Through the door came the sounds of Kutuzov's voice, excited and dissatisfied, interrupted by another, an unfamiliar voice. From the sound of these voices, the inattentive way Kozlovsky looked at him, the disrespectful manner of the exhausted clerk, the fact that the clerk and Kozlovsky were squatting on the floor by a tub so near to the commander-in-chief, and from the noisy laughter of the Cossacks holding the horses near the window, Prince Andrew felt that something important and disastrous was about to happen. He turned to Kozlovsky with urgent questions.
Immediately, Prince, said Kozlovsky, dispositions for Bagration.
What about capitulation?
Nothing of the sort. Orders are issued for a battle.
Prince Andrew moved towards the door from whence voices were heard. Just as he was going to open it, the sounds ceased. The doors opened and Kutuzov, with his eagle nose and puffy face, appeared in the doorway. Prince Andrew stood right in front of Kutuzov, but the expression of the commander-in-chief's one sound eye showed him to be so preoccupied with thoughts and anxieties as to be oblivious of his presence. He looked straight at his adjutant's face without recognizing him.
"Well, have you finished?" said he to Kozlovsky.
"One moment, Your Excellency." Bagration, a gaunt, middle-aged man of medium height with a firm, impassive face of Oriental type, came out after the commander-in-chief.
"I have the honour to present myself," repeated Prince Andrew rather loudly, handing Kutuzov an envelope.
"Ah, from Vienna? Very good. Later, later."
Kutuzov went out into the porch with Bagration.
"Well, goodbye, Prince," said he to Bagration. "My blessing, and may Christ be with you in your great endeavour."
His face suddenly softened, and tears came into his eyes. With his left hand he drew Bagration towards him, and with his right, on which he wore a ring, he made the sign of the cross over him, with a gesture, evidently habitual, offering his puffy cheek, but Bagration kissed him on the neck instead.
"Christ be with you," Kutuzov repeated, and went towards his carriage.
"Get in with me," said he to Bolkonski.
"Your Excellency, I should like to be of use here. Allow me to remain with Prince Bagration's detachment."
"Get in," said Kutuzov, and noticing that Bolkonski still delayed, he added, "I need good officers myself, need them myself."
They got into the carriage and drove for a few minutes in silence. "There is still much, much before us," he said, as if with an old man's penetration he understood all that was passing in Bolkonski's mind. "If a tenth part of his detachment returns, I shall thank God," he added, as if speaking to himself. Prince Andrew glanced at Kutuzov's face only a foot distance from him and involuntarily noticed the carefully washed seams of the scar near his temple where an Ismail bullet had pierced his skull and the empty eye socket. "Yes, he has a right to speak so calmly of those men's death," thought Bolkonski. "That is why I beg to be sent to the detachment," he said. Kutuzov did not reply. He seemed to have forgotten what he had been saying and sat plunged in thought. 5 minutes later, gently swaying on the soft springs of the carriage, he turned to Prince Andrew. There was not a trace of agitation on his face. With delicate irony, he questioned Prince Andrew about the details of his interview with the Emperor, about the remarks he had heard at court concerning the Krems affair, and about some ladies they both knew.
"All right, there we have it. Another chapter down. Prince Andrei is getting rather fearless. You know, when everyone's retreating, he's heading the opposite way to meet up with Kutuzov and his army. And then in this chapter, Kutuzov has revealed to him that they're not going to retreat, they are going to fight the French. And what does Andrei do? He says, 'Sign me up, I'm in.' He's certainly proving to be quite brave. On the way back to meet with Kutuzov, he had this little run-in with the doctor and the doctor's wife and one of the Russian officers who was giving them a bit of trouble. That was an interesting little scene, which we'll talk about in a minute. And then it was quite cool to see Kutuzov sort of firsthand and get to know him a little better, hear his voice, and interact with him via Andrei. Reddit user Rusifi said, "The interaction with the doctor's wife confuses me. Andrei initially decides to confront the officer, I think, out of a sense of gentlemanly duty. When he is first rebuffed, he simply lets it go and leaves the woman to her fate. He only really stands up to the officer after a voice in the background suggests that he is both little and has been given a nice snub. But after all this is said and done, Andrei is embarrassed by his hasty action. Why? Because he let his temper get to him? Because he stepped out of line in terms of military rank by confronting an officer? Because he made himself look too caring when he should be preparing for battle? Over the past few chapters, I've noticed that Andrei seems to be in continual conflict between his role in so-called proper high society, which he ostensibly loathes, and the real life of war. Andrei dismisses the social climbing of the living room, but rather seems eager to prove himself and be celebrated for his acts of bravery in war. He is accepted in the previous chapter by the diplomats and wants their congratulations, but is also eager to go back to the front lines. Maybe this interaction with the doctor's wife is part of that conflict. Another Reddit user, Sonic Vroom, said, "The incident involving the doctor's wife also illustrates the bravery of Prince Andrei, approaching an officer and everything, as well as the chaos within the Russian army. Nobody expected the French battalion to cross the bridge to Brünn. Quickly, the people of importance must be evacuated. There was no time to give thorough orders to the soldiers, and disorder ensues. Kutuzov, on the other hand, understands the situation. He is realistic and serious, and taking religious precautions. Not a good omen. Why are they writing on the underside of a tub, though? I'm assuming this is a tub of provisions, maybe with a secret message between commanders." Yeah, there is this big contrast between Prince Andrei and all the sort of soldiers. Everyone seems to be retreating, and they're all hungry, and they're getting a bit desperate, and yet Prince Andrei is so kind of switched on and eager and calm. In response to this comment by Sonic Vroom, Quittaset said, "I agree that the incident with the doctor's wife shows Andrei's courage on the one hand. On the other hand, I find it interesting how strong a reaction he has to the potential ridicule that might result from his stepping in here. The way he helps, but then rides off quickly without looking back at her as she calls him her savior, reminds me of a kid in school making an overture to a new or unpopular kid, getting laughed at for it, and completing the overture, but in an embarrassed sort of way that suggests that he's not going to do it again. As for the tub, It's not so much that the clerk is writing on the actual underside of the tub, as that he has turned a tub upside down to use as a makeshift table as he writes. It goes to show just how quickly the army is moving and how much it is in disarray. Yeah, that's the way I saw it as well, the tub being flipped over so that they can write on it, use it as a little table, was there to show that this place had been set up quite quickly, and they weren't putting too much effort into setting it up because they sort of knew they were going to have to move on again, so it was just use what's around sort of thing. Regarding Kutuzov, Reddit user Alfimon said, "I don't know much about the real Kutuzov, but in this chapter I saw him as a great military leader. On one hand, he is clear-headed even with the French army almost on him. He is able to prioritize the important things to do, for example, not engaging with André and the news of the Austrian court until dispatching the orders for the retreat. On the other hand, he has empathy for his subordinates. He almost asks for forgiveness to Bagration because he knows he is sending him to his death." Kutuzov's face suddenly softened and tears welled up in his eyes. He is also able to read André's thoughts. "There is still much before us, much of everything," he said with an old man's perceptive expression, as though he understood everything that was going on in Bolkonski's soul. This combination of rational and logical thinking with emotional and psychological understanding marks a great leader. That's a really different perspective from how I saw Kutuzov in this chapter, but I think it's really valid as well, and you've kind of turned me a bit towards your viewpoint. What I saw was a man who was a great leader, but he seemed to me to be overwhelmed, like he kind of knew that, oh yeah, we're in a really bad spot here, and I saw the kind of emotional side of him as maybe out of character, because he's sort of, it's the end of the war for him. And so I saw him as a little bit almost flustered. He didn't really make any mistakes, he did everything right, but he seemed a bit flustered and sort of distracted even. But now that I've read your comment, Alfimon, I start to think if maybe I just read it wrong and you're actually closer to the mark. And so that's it. The chapter ends with André volunteering himself to serve Kutuzov and showing his bravery and his willingness to fight. All right, that seems like a good place to leave this episode. Thanks very much for listening, and I will see you tomorrow.